Hi, thanks everybody for coming at this joint Hellenic Observatory and LSE Research Unit on Southeast Europe event. So the two research units of the European Institute looking at Greece and the Balkans. The event today is on a topic of Greek interest, but I think also of wider interest in the region, Greek exports and corporate adjustments. The debate will be centered around a paper co-authored by Anthony Vatzokas and Peter Sanfi, exactly on the topic of Greek exports and corporate adjustment. So we'll have the two authors speaking first, and then we'll have comments and intervention by, I'll discuss them, Galenianos, and then we'll open it up to discussion in questions and answers from the audience. So let me briefly introduce the speakers to you. I'll start with Anthony, Professor Anthony Vatzokas is an alternate board director at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. He is an economist, has a PhD in economics, in the economics of technological change, and he's a professorial fellow at Athens University and also University of Maastricht. His work in recent years has focused on trajectories of technological change with special reference to the role of financial markets, industrial organization and environmental regulation in developed and industrialized countries. At the very end of the table, Dr. Peter Sanfi is Deputy Director for Country Economics and Policy within the Economics, Policy and Governance Department of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development in London. He's also Senior Visiting Fellow at LISE, the Research Unit on Southeast Europe here at the LSE, and among his main duties, he's responsible for the analysis of economic developments and reforms in Southeastern Europe. He engages in research and publications on a range of topics covering the whole transition region. He graduated from Trinity College in Dublin and with a BA in economics, and received his PhD in economics at Yale. He's published widely, I don't want to tire you with publications. And our discussion is, to my left is Professor Manolis Galenianos. He's Professor of Economics at the Department of Economics in Royal Holloway University of London, and he's also co-author of one of the, I think, highly publicized chapters on a recent book about, I forget the title now, but it's After Austerity, Beyond Austerity, yes, not after, Beyond Austerity, looking in particular trade and export performance and the adjustment of Greece in relation to trade. So all I need to do now is tell you that the Twitter hashtag has LSE Greece, if you want to tweet. That's all I know about this thing. So I'll stay quiet now and I'll pass the floor to, I think Peter will start first with the presentation. Peter.
Thank you very much, Vasilis. I prefer to stand up and when I'm speaking. Evening, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be to have the opportunity to present this work to you this evening. Let me make just a couple of disclaimers and acknowledgements early on. The disclaimer is the usual one that from both Anthony and myself, that we're here in our personal capacity, and any views we express tonight are our own and not necessarily those of the EBRD. Also, the paper actually has a third co-author. It's Christos Papazoglou from the Bank of Greece. So nothing we say tonight should be attributed to the Bank of Greece either. Christos, unfortunately, is not able to join us here for this presentation. But I want to, we've carved it up between us, Anthony and I, that I will kick off and give you a quick outline of this paper, and then Anthony will come in and talk a bit more about the policy implications and the role of the EBRD, how we can hopefully help improve Greece's export performance. Now, the background to the paper is, why do we do this paper? We did it as background material for a major one-day conference hosted by the Bank of Greece a couple of months ago, in December, actually. Before Christmas. And this was a conference, a bit unusual for the Bank of Greece to organize a conference on exports, but I think it was a very interesting and worthwhile event because it caught the views not of monetary policy experts or central bankers, but it brought in the views of the banks, but also of the real sector, of actual Greek corporates. And it really gave, I think, us an insight into what is going on in the corporate sector, why Greece's export performance has been disappointing, and what might be done about it. So that's, in essence, what the paper is about. Last thing, by way of background, to say is that it's standard to say at the start that we welcome comments and suggestions, but we really do welcome comments and suggestions today, because this is quite preliminary work, and we would like to extend the paper in a number of directions, but we're not quite sure how, and so we will be inviting your views on that as the discussion goes on. So we will keep our speaking slots quite short. We're very much looking forward to hearing Manolis on this. Manolis, I think, being one of the leading experts on Greece's trade performance, and then the views of all of you. So the paper, a rough summary here, it starts from the observation that the Greek economy is relatively closed, and that the exports are often concentrated in relatively low value-added products. Of course, when something is low or below potential, you can see that as a positive thing, that there must be potential for strong growth in the future, provided the right conditions are in place. So the focus of the analysis, therefore, is really on what are those obstacles? Why is Greece underperforming on exports? What's holding Greece back? And for that, I will sketch out to you some brief results from a major survey that we and the World Bank have done in Greece recently. And then Anthony, as I say, will talk a bit more about some of the policy implications, including those relating to capital controls, but also relating to the assumed non-performing loans and how to tackle those, how to reverse the brain drain, and how to develop the appropriate infrastructure for exports of both goods and services. So let me just take you through a few charts and so on. So just to illustrate the relative closedness of the economy, this is the standard measure of trade openness, which is exports plus imports divided by GDP. In Greece, it's below 60%. In the Eurozone, the average is typically around close to 90%. So you often hear in the debate, even from we've even heard from government ministers, that the acknowledgement that Greece is in some ways a closed or a quasi-closed economy. Now, to understand that, I think it's worth looking just briefly at the structure of exports. Again, this is the most recent data we have, 2016. You see that exports is a strong, it's relatively diversified, but there is a strong concentration in certain goods, particularly oil and other mineral fuels. Greece both exports and imports substantially in that category, but also food and live animals and other agricultural products feature prominently as well as chemicals and related products and other manufactured goods. So the point is that some of this is concentrated in relatively low value-added products, and Greece has not really been successful to date in integrating into the high value, global value chains. So that is a challenge, if you like, for the future. And in terms of the potential for future growth, now on this chart, this is very preliminary. So this is drawing on some previous work by our co-author Christos Papazoglou. It's based on a gravity model of trade. If you're familiar, the concept of gravity model familiar to most of you. So we've taken the estimates from that previous model, which was estimated across a wide range of countries, and applied it to the current trade structure. So that's really just a first pass, if you like, at how Greece's exports are below what you would expect for a country of its size and its GDP and its proximity to other relatively rich countries. countries. So in terms of the trade with neighboring countries in Southeastern Europe and plus Turkey, the trade is actually close to what you would expect from this model. So the ratio of potential to actual exports is just 1.1. But contrast that with the rest of the world, where there's a big gap between what exports actually are and what you would expect them to be on the basis of this model. This is one area where we will probably try to extend the paper and refine the estimates, but it I think illustrates the point, the broad point, quite nicely. Now, so what's holding back exports? Well, here we have the advantage of a major survey that we and the World Bank have done. Now, the survey is called the Business Environment and Enterprise Performance Survey, so BEPS for short. BEPS may be familiar to those of you who've looked at over the years at survey data for countries where the EBRD is operating. It's a long-standing survey that we have been doing jointly with the World Bank. The first round was back in 1999, and it covers pretty much the whole region where the EBRD is operating. So more than 30 countries in emerging Europe and Central Asia, and indeed has been extended also to Northern Africa, Middle East, some of the countries where we're now investing. So the value of BEPS is that it's a detailed survey, face-to-face interview of businesses on the ground. So it's not economists in London or Washington pontificating about what the problems are. It's the voice of businesses on the ground telling us what's holding them back, what are the biggest obstacles they face. It is quite a lengthy survey. It has a wide range of information, but it's best known, I think, for these subjective expressions of problems that businesses face on the ground. And in that sense, it's a very useful complement to other cross-country studies of the business environment. I'm thinking here, for example, of the World Bank's Doing Business report, which is much more about laws on the books. This is really about how people are affected in their day-to-day operations. So it's always intended to be, and best practice is used to try and get a representative sample of the private sector in the country. Now, I said BEEP started in 1999. Because we at the EBRD are now on a temporary basis investing in Greece and also Cyprus, we carried out the survey in 2016 in these two countries. So it's actually not the first time we did the survey in Greece. So in 2004, it was decided to have a few EU comparator countries. So I think we did Germany and I think Portugal, if I recall correctly, was the other one. But Greece also was included at the time. But in 2016, it's included because it's now a country that we really have a strong interest in for its own sake, because we are an investor there, and Anthony will say more about those. So it was carried out, the fieldwork was done between March and August 2016, and we had a sample of 323 firms. Now, to get at this question of obstacles, so this is an example of a question people are asked. So this is a question about corruption, and they're asked, to what degree is corruption an obstacle to the current operations of this establishment? And you can answer this on, you have five categories, so think of it as a 5-point scale, which ranges from no obstacle, which would be scored as zero, then goes to minor obstacle, moderate obstacle, major obstacle, and the worst category is this very severe obstacle, which will be scored as a four. There's a separate question also which gives a whole list of obstacles, 15 in total, and asks what's the biggest obstacle facing your establishment. So it's things like corruption, access to finance, tax rates, lack of skilled labour force, land registration problems, quality of infrastructure, and so on. A whole range of issues that can face a business. And as I say, we find it very useful in understanding better how businesses on the ground the problems that they face on a day-to-day basis. Now, what we found is the following. The numbers might be a little bit small to read, but let me just talk you through a few of the findings. So, firstly, we've grouped this table, just to make it a little bit easier, the bottom two categories are grouped together, no or minor obstacle. The top two are also grouped together, major and very severe obstacle. And we've divided the sample into those firms that don't export, so the domestically oriented ones, and those that do have at least some of their sales from exports. The results are not that different between the two groups, but the problems that crop up very prominently are, number one is political instability, and perhaps that's not surprising from the perspective of 2016. So 86% of domestically oriented firms and 89% of exporters said this is either a major or a very severe obstacle. Then you have tax rates. Again, no surprise, I think, to anyone, given the high tax rates that businesses face and the increases they've had to face in recent years. Tax administration also is a prominent issue. Corruption is a significant problem for businesses. Labour regulations comes next, and then access to finance. And with access to finance, it's more of a problem for exporters than it is for domestically oriented firms. And again, that's just something that where we, with our financial resources, can help, and Anthony will talk a bit more about that later. So this gives you the picture of how businesses are facing, what kind of problems they face on the ground. Now, we've done a little bit further analysis. So we looked at the division between the exporters, and we divided them into what we call superstars, big players and small players. So the superstar exporters are those in the top. Firstly, you can rank exporters by the value of exporting. So in other words, the total value of exports weighted by the percentage of their sales that actually go towards exports rather than domestically. And in the top five percentile, you have the superstars. So this is a very small number of companies that are really dominating the export scene in weeks, or at least in our sample. Typically, they are older than the other companies. And as you can see in that column on employees, they started small, typically, with 11 employees on average, and now they have an average 330. So these are companies that have built themselves up to be major players. Then you have the big players and the small players, which tend to be a lot, of course, smaller. The small player exporters, on average, have just 15 employees. Last thing to notice on this table is that the superstar exporters tend to be mainly foreign-owned, or have a very high share of foreign ownership. Now, this leads us to one more question, and then I'll stop and hand over to Anthony, which is, are the exporters more productive than the domestically oriented firms? So we've done, a very preliminary econometric analysis in the paper. So this table is a table of econometric results. There are four different columns, so four different specifications. Two for where employment is the dependent variable, employment being a measure of a firm's size, and two which look at determinants of labour productivity. Now, what we conclude from this paper is that if you look just at the first two columns, which treats all exporters together, and focus on in the middle row, you have the dummy variable for whether a company is a direct exporter or not, and the cutoff there is at least 10% of their sales come from exports. Well, there is some evidence that direct exporters tend to be a bit bigger, But there's very little evidence from that that they are more productive. Okay, because that's the... So I'm talking about these two, these coefficients here. So the direct exporters tend to be a bit bigger. It's associated with being having more employees. But the this coefficient here, although it is positive, it's not statistically significant. Now, if you then break up the sample into the superstars and the big exporters and the small exporters, then you do see that the superstar exporters and indeed the big exporters tend to be both bigger and more productive. But the small player exporters, there's no difference really in their size or their productivity relatively to domestically oriented firms. So we see this as a quite an important conclusion, given that really the Greek economy, even the export sector, is absolutely dominated by very small firms. And it's a point Manolis in his paper in that book that Vasilis mentioned is also touches on. Given that dominance, these people tend not to be more productive than the domestically oriented firms, at least in our sample. And that is really, I think, one of the issues, one of the fundamental issues that needs to be addressed over time. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Anthony, I'm going to pass the floor to you to tell us more about the policy implications and what we do.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, I will need 5 or 7 minutes to really give you the kind of market practitioner perspective on what we're discussing today. So the idea is that if you look at the narrative of the Greek adjustment program, first, second, third, in all three cases, you know, there is a strong emphasis about, you know, export orientation. That will be the path towards a sustainable Greek economy. Now, we approach this from a kind of development bank with a public mandate perspective. What a development bank could do in this kind of environment? One thing is to really take for granted that the adjustment program is progressing. One thing is to say that horizontal reforms will take place. And then we look at firm level reactions and we try to calibrate what we are doing. This is as far as Peter went. But there is another kind of medium level that we try to understand in the case of the Greek economy, and I would like to share with you some insights about that. We came to the conclusion that when it comes to the Greek economy, an issue of critical importance is the cost of a prolonged recession and how that is distorting and creating obstacles for the real economy. So what I'm going to discuss now is, you know, what are the core issues of the negative implications of this prolonged recession, and what we learned on the ground when we tried to implement some of the policy and the, you know, instruments that the bank has. So what are the legacy issues, what are the structural obstacles that we observed in the case of the Greek economy? In the kind of measure level, apart from firm level analysis. First issue of critical importance is NPLs. NPLs are not just about zombie firms. NPLs are also about deleveraging and credit constraints in the economy. We know that the Greek economy for years to come will have a persistent funding gap, and NPLs is an important factor of that. So this is the first legacy issue. Second, people talk about firm level dynamics. The Greek economy needs to adjust, so we need new blood in the economy. But then we have two very important measure level obstacles. First, that access to capital is not granted for these new companies in a way, and also brain drain is depleting resources from the economy. So this is the second legacy issue. Third, all this narrative about, you know, export orientation is really about tradable goods, but also tradable services. when you look at the realities of the Greek economy, tradable services, in order to become, you know, bankable and exportable, we need an extensive restructuring of existing corporates, but also soft infrastructure, which is not there. So third issue. Fourth, we observe that many Greek companies try to export and reach out to new markets, middle-level developing countries. There the problem is that they try once, and then there is no continuity, because the intensive margin in these economies is very limited for Greek type of products. Fifth, structural problem, legacy of recession, is capital controls. It is important. I mean, in the paper we make a number of points about capital controls, but it's important to underline that the impact of capital controls in the Greek economy is generic. It isn't just about, you know, predictability. It's also about the way companies will develop their strategies for the near-term future. And it's a very important signal for the market. So these are the kind of measure-level obstacles that we observe because of the prolonged recession of the Greek economy. Now, let me become a bit more practical. EBRD is operating in Greece for the last 3 years. We have approved 2.5 billion investment in the private sector. We have committed so far on 5.6. And now we'll try to share with you some insights on how some of the work we have done is really useful to understand, you know, problems, obstacles, and opportunities for export orientation of the Greek economy. The first issue, and it's quite revealing, is the trade facilitation lines that we introduced in the Greek economy in the last 3 years. I will remind you that, you know, 3 years back, 4 years back, the Greek banks were completely cut off. Not only in terms of repos, but any kind of transaction with the outside world. So when we started the trade facilitation lines with Greek banks, it was the first step for them to reach out to the banking system, the global banking system. Right now, our trade facilitation lines in Greece are 1/4 of the trade facilitation business that EBRD does in 36 countries. So you can see how much important the gap was in this situation. What is interesting is that apart from guarantees for, you know, trade, we provide also performance bonds. And that has been really tackling a very important gap in the market as Greek companies are trying to reach out to foreign markets. So with the trade facilitation lines, we identified a very important problem. But in order to export, you need banks to support and facilitate this process. And if your banking system is not of a quality that can reach out to the outside world, you have a serious problem. Our second interesting initiative was the participation in the privatization of Greek airports. There, it is very clear that by improving the quality of Greek airports, the revenues from tourism will increase in years to come. One third interesting issue that we observed at the very beginning, and we played some role there, was the export orientation of business groups. In Greece, we have a thin layer of 20-25 business groups, and they all try to reach out to the export markets in order to survive. It is very interesting to see how this process complemented and enhanced their credibility and access to capital. So when we came in and tried to support them with corporate bonds, the fact that they were expanding their export orientation facilitated this process. So this is the third insight I would like to share with you. The fourth insight is about who is bankable in Greece right now. If you talk to banks, and when we organized this conference with the Bank of Greece, the banks were asked, they will say, we will finance anything of good quality. What they really mean is that in Greece right now we have a thin layer of star exporters, and every bank is, you know, trying to get them and finance them. The problem is that there is an increasing gap between the star exporters and all the rest. And we need to find a way to mitigate, you know, this increasing gap in the Greek economy. Fifth insight that I would like to share with you is the importance and the need of tailor-made technical assistance for Greek SMEs. By that I mean that in the last 20 years we have seen a lot of technical assistance programs in Greece, but they have been very bureaucratic and they have not really targeting the real needs of exporting SMEs. When we tried to assess this market in order to introduce our relevant product, that was quite evident. And we are starting a program on this. So these are the kind of practical examples and insights from EBRD's activities in Greece related to export orientation. Final point. If you would ask me what will be the kind of short-term advice for a Greek policymaker, I would say 4 points. Recovery and export orientation in Greece, apart from the first layer of business groups, is about SMEs. So we need really to understand what are the needs of different segments of SMEs in the Greek market. Second, NPLs by all means is a problem which is a huge stock problem and needs to be resolved. Third, capital controls. Capital controls is an issue detrimental for economic confidence and economic sentiment in Greece. So the sooner we remove, the better. And finally, brain drain. I already linked brain drain with the importance of new firm level dynamics in the Greek economy. And at some point, when economic sentiment will improve, there needs to be a policy or initiatives to bring human capital back in Greece. So I'll stop here, and we are really willing to listen to you and get your comments. Actually, we are trying to find ways to expand further the paper in different directions. And one of the directions we are thinking is, okay, what is the cost of a prolonged recession? What are the measure level obstacles that it creates? And how you can, you know, introduce policy instruments in order to overcome this kind of obstacles. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me to discuss this very interesting paper. So I want to do in this discussion two things. First, I want to give you some context about why the question of exports is an important question. Okay, so the Greek economy has a multitude of problems, but I want to argue that exports and promoting exports should be at the very top of our concern. And then I'll go into a bit more detailed and look at some more detailed data, which I will then link back to the suggestions of and the comments made by the author. And the first part, the context bit, is going to be based on some work I've done with co-authors. I'll mention in a second. So going into the crisis, so in 2009, Greece suffered of what's been called the twin deficits. So Greece had a huge deficit, so the Greek government had a huge deficit in its budget, and also Greece as a country, as a whole, had a huge deficit in its current account. Okay, so when I'm talking about current account, you should think about the trade balance. So both of those deficits required financing. Okay, so the government needs to borrow in order to pay its bills, but also the country as a whole, Greece as a whole, has to borrow from abroad in order to cover the cost of imports. Okay, part of the cost can be covered by exporting, but since you have a deficit, the rest somehow you have to find the funds. And then of course when the crisis started, the rest of the world, foreigners, stopped being willing to finance both the Greek government and also Greece as a country. Now public discourse in Greece and Europe has focused almost exclusively on the issue of the government deficit. And I think this is a mistake. In order to understand the crisis and how to get out of the crisis, it is equally important to understand what's going on in the current account. Okay, so here on this graph, I guess you can see, right? So Greece had the biggest budget deficit in 2009 and also the biggest current account deficit in 2009 as well. Okay, so what happens is, how can a country reduce its trade deficit? Well, there's two ways. You can either increase your exports or you can reduce your imports. Of course, it is preferable to reduce your trade deficit by increasing your exports, because that keeps production in the country, that keeps employment in the country. Okay. The alternative is to reduce your imports, which necessitates a compression of income. Okay. So, for example, when you compress income, people consume less, and therefore they import fewer consumable goods. Okay. Now, what happened since then? Since the beginning of the crisis, Greece and also the other countries that required bailouts have greatly improved their trade balance. So here you can see on this graph the change of the trade balance in the first few years after the crisis. So the blue bars here report the improvement in the trade balance as a share of 2008 GDP. So you see Greece here had a very substantial improvement of more than 10% of GDP. Okay, so if you compare across the experience of other countries, this is very, very large. Okay, so Spain and Portugal similarly have very, very large improvements in their trade balance. Okay, so far, so good. Now, what is somewhat dispiriting about this feature, this picture, is that in the case of Greece, the improvement in the trade balance happened exclusively, almost exclusively, through the compression of imports, and despite the need for exports, Greek exports increased very, very little. Okay, so this is the orange bar here that you can hardly see. Okay, now if you compare Greece's experience with Spain and Portugal, you see a very different picture. Spain and Portugal also recorded very large improvements in their trade balance. However, 2/3 to 3/4 of that improvement was driven by increase in their exports. Okay, so this means that although Spain and Portugal had severe recessions, their recessions were nothing as compared to what happened to Greece. So the experience of Spain and Portugal also suggests that the international environment was not quite as negative. I mean, it was not positive, but it was not so negative to mean that you could not increase your exports. Okay, Spain and Portugal managed to do it. So then the question is why Greece was unable to increase its exports. One question that you have to answer here is, was it even feasible for Greece to increase its exports? Okay, so maybe it's a very closed economy that is incapable of exporting. Maybe you need a wholesale reboot of the country or something like that. To the question, was export growth feasible for Greece? We answer an emphatic yes. We is Kostas Sarkoulakis, Aristos Doxiadis, and myself. In the chapter we wrote in this collected volume, Beyond Austerity. Okay, it was published a few months ago by MRP Press. So what we report there is we report our estimates that Greek exports should have increased by 25%. Okay, I'll tell you where we get this number in a second. And furthermore, had exports grown according to that potential, then the recession would have been considerably milder. In particular, 1/3 milder. GDP today would have been 20 billion larger. Okay, so Greece would still have had a very severe recession, but not quite as severe as what happened. Okay, so where do those numbers come from? So this calculation is based on Greece's pre-crisis export performance. Okay, so we base this data not on, this is not a pie in the sky. We're just looking at what was the performance before the crisis for Greece and also for other countries. Okay. So what we do is we look at data on GDP, exports, imports, and a number of other variables. We use some economic theory to estimate the export potential of Greece and other countries. Okay, what I mean by potential is that this means that once we have the export potential of a country, we can calculate its level of exports if economic circumstances change. Okay, the change in economic circumstances in this particular instance, of course, is the fact that foreigners are unwilling to finance the trade deficit of Greece, and therefore Greek exports have to increase or imports have to decline. Okay. So that's what we do there, and that's how we get the 25%. Okay. So despite the fact that the Greek economy was indeed relatively closed, okay, in comparison to other European economies, still, Despite taking that fact into account, we still would have predicted a large increase in exports in response to the need to reduce the trade deficit. So final point here is that this export potential, which is non-trivial, is consistent with the export performance of Greece in the first decade of the euro. And this is something that somehow kind of has fallen through the cracks. I don't think people realize that between 1999 and 2008, Greece had the largest increase in exports among all countries in the eurozone. Okay? Greece increased exports by a larger proportion than Germany or Ireland. Okay? At the same time, of course, imports increased even faster, which is why the trade deficit rose. Okay, so to go back to Peter's previous point, of course, Greece is still relatively closed, is more closed as an economy than the other European countries. However, 10 or 20 years ago, it was even more closed than it is now. Right? So you can look at Greece's performance over the last 20, 25 years as a process of converging towards, let's say, some European average, but having started quite far away. Okay, this is my second final point on this slide. I wanted then to also stress that in an economy like Greece's today, where internal sources of growth are basically non-existent, okay, so the government cannot jumpstart growth because it's very constrained. Consumers cannot spend money. Okay, so perhaps investment is the solution, but the external sector is the only sector of the economy that can provide sort of a consistent source of demand for the economy. Okay, so this is an additional reason of for which exports are actually very important for Greece's economic performance right now. So that's sort of in terms of context. Now let's go a little bit to specifics. Right, so we have these missing exports. So what I'm going to show you here is a comparison of the export performance of Greece. Again, I'm going to show you Spain and Portugal just to get a point of comparison, some context. And I'm going to show you both pre- and post-crisis, the pre- and post-crisis developments. So as you can see here, so this is what I mentioned before, Greek exports increased by two-thirds between 2000 and 2008. Okay. Spain and Portugal increased also substantially by about 10 to 15 percentage points less than Greek exports. Now, if you look at the post-crisis performance, so these figures go all the way to 2016. So actually, total exports dropped in the meantime. So actually, total exports dropped significantly between 2014 and 2016. I think something happened in between those years. Anyway, Spain and Portugal, you see, reported very large, very high increases in their exports, more than 30%. Okay, not as much as the previous period, but of course, post 2008, the global economy was in a much worse position also. All right, so how can we understand this very poor export performance? Now we can look at a bit more detail here. Okay, so services here, as you see, recorded a very, very large decline. Services of Greece, the value of services exported declined by 22% between 2008 and 2016. This is particularly important for the Greek economy because Greece has specialized on exporting services. Okay, so uniquely, Greece's exports are 55% services, 45% goods. In most other countries, services account for about 20-25% of total exports. There's nothing bad about this, by the way. It's just a feature of the Greek economy. So when services tank, as they did, that's a bad thing. Now, why did services decline so much? This is actually all due to transportation. Okay? In particular, this means shipping. And in this particular instance, actually, the culprit is not in Greece. It's that shipping prices collapsed. So I don't know how closely maybe you follow those things, but before the 2008 recession, there was overbuilding of ships, so the prices to ship things like dry cargo or containers dropped very, very much after the crisis. Nevertheless, the rest of the services, in particular tourism, increased very, very little also, so could not undo essentially these this globally induced reduction in the value of exports of services. Okay, so furthermore, if we go to the export of goods, you see that the value of goods exported increased by about 15%, which is less than half of what Spain and Portugal, less than half the increase of Spain and Portugal. Okay, so there's still something to be explained here. Now, if you disaggregate this figure a little bit more, what you find is that exports of agriculture-related products, that includes processed goods, as well as just raw goods, but also processed, and also mineral products, increased by more than 40%. So those sectors seem to have done well, but manufacturing exports, and I include here chemicals, stagnated. And these are the sectors that increased most substantially for the other countries. Okay, I hope I haven't sort of overburdened you here with numbers. Now I want to. What are the main takeaways? In the first decade of the euro, Greece's exports increased substantially. Since then, they haven't. The service decline is due to transportation, and the goods' poor performance is due to manufacturing. Okay, so what? Let's go into more into specifics on what explains the underperformance of exports. Now we have to focus on manufacturing. Okay, so transportation is because of global factors. Okay, so there's nothing we can do about that. But manufacturing occurs in Greece, and that's important. Now, to export from Greece, you need competitive production. Okay, and by this I mean that the costs within Greece need to be low. And you also need to invest. You need to invest not just in productive capacity, but also in the things that Anthony mentioned, relationship with new markets. So this is not just, you cannot just pick up the phone and ship some product somewhere. So you have to know who to ship it to. They have to know you. They have to trust you. You have to create the relationship. Okay, that takes time. This is a form of investment. Anthony, Peter, and co-author do in their paper is that they examine this survey data where they ask specific firms about what the obstacles are. So I think this is a very, very valuable exercise. This is in some sense the exact opposite from what I do with my co-authors in our work. And these are, for this reason, these are very complementary. Now, the important finding, at least as I see this, is that most of the obstacles that they report have to do with exactly hindering investment. Okay, and I want to contrast this again with my work. We focused on the competitiveness of production, so the cost of inputs. So what we found there is that wages have dropped substantially in Greece during that time. So actually, labor competitiveness has been recovered. Okay? Now, of course, one of the findings that personally found more interesting in the paper is that actually labor regulation seems to be very burdensome, in particular for exporting firms. Okay, so this is something that I haven't realized looking at only wages. Okay, obviously, there's other dimensions to labor relations which are not captured by wages. Okay, so perhaps even though wages have fallen, labor markets are still not operating very well. Okay. So furthermore, the other dimension that we looked in our work is prices, and we found that prices have not dropped so much in Greece presumably because of limited competition within the country, and this is a way of hindering cost competitiveness for Greece. I want to make a few suggestions to the author. So these are things that I would like to see, and I think they have a lot of the data to do that. Going back to this slide, so there's at least two dimensions here, two levels of comparison that I think are interesting. So Greece before and post crisis, okay, so success and failure. Okay, secondly, even after the crisis, we have sectors that have been more successful in exporting, like agricultural and mineral, and sectors that are less successful. Okay? So can we understand something about what distinguishes those different sectors or those different time periods? In particular, in their data, if they can look at the firms that they have, the exporting firms, and they split it across sectors, okay, I think it would be very interesting to see, for example, if agricultural-related sectors are less worried by you know, some of, for example, capital controls or something like that. Okay. They would be interesting to see. So my, I don't know, my intuition, but you know, who knows whether that's true, is that perhaps manufacturing is more dependent on intermediate goods. Okay, so they take an intermediate good, they you know add some value, then resell it, and many of those intermediate goods are perhaps purchased from abroad. So once you have capital controls, it becomes very difficult to import, add some value, and then re-export. While if you're an agricultural, if you're selling processed food, for example, perhaps all of most of the production occurs within Greece, and so you know capital controls don't affect you as much. Maybe this is just a speculation. Furthermore, okay, so if we look back at the 2000s, so of course some of the obstacles here were less, you know, political instability was not a problem there, capital controls were not a problem. Corruption, it's not clear to me if it was as big a problem then as now. I don't know, at the top of my head I wouldn't have, it's not obvious that it has gotten worse. On some sectors, I suppose things got better, so things like labor relations probably are better now than they were back then. So is there a way of actually going back in time? So probably, I mean, I understand this survey is new, but you know, maybe some of those factors we can compare with the evidence from perhaps the World Bank survey. Okay. Oh yes, and final thing. I think the final one of the points that Anthony mentioned is particularly important, which is how do you get new firms to export? Okay, so given that they have to go through this investment period, okay, that's what seems to make things quite a bit harder. So in your data, do you have data specifically on firms that have started exporting very recently, and perhaps look at the obstacles they report and see if those reports are different from other more established firms? I think this is because basically, okay, more established firms are already exporting, perhaps they don't need so much extra help. Perhaps it's new firms that we should focus on. Okay, so I very much enjoyed reading the paper then and thinking about those issues, so thank you for having me here.
Let me thank all three speakers, the presenters of the discussion. I don't know if you would like to take some time to respond to some of the things that Manolis raised, or if you would like me to open the floor for questions and answers. So would either of you would like to?
No, it's really food for thought. And, I would say that apart from the survey that we used, there are two different data sets that we could use in order to address some of these questions. I mean, there is the European Central Bank SME survey that captures some of your comments. There is the European Investment Bank survey that also, you know, tracing some of the your comments. So we'll look at it.
But I think, just to add to that, I think we can get at some of these issues in the BEAM stage as well. There's a very valuable suggestions. One thing that struck me, maybe just an observation, I recall from your paper, Manolis, you emphasize, you contrast the progress on labor market reform and combined also with big wage reductions, which of course are very unpleasant for those who have to suffer them, but at least they do improve competitiveness. But you contrast that with product markets, which don't seem to have adjusted so much now. There has been some progress in the last year or two in product market regulations, these OECD toolkit reforms and so on, so maybe we'll see more progress on that over time. But it does strike me that probably the economy is still, it's not just relatively closed for exports, but it's also, in some sectors at least, relatively uncompetitive. It's dominated by some big firms. We don't really get that picture from the BEAM because we're all seeing existing firms. We're not. One big flaw of any survey like this one is that you don't get to ask the firms that didn't enter or that collapsed, perhaps because they were squeezed out by anti-competitive practices.
Right, let me kick off the discussion and raise a point. Actually, it cuts across both the presentation of the discussion by Manolis. So you both refer to kind of predicting potential exports, you know, export capacity, potential export growth, and I'm very familiar with gravity models, so I'm playing a bit devil's advocate. But in a way, you do find, you know, in the paper by Pazoglu, in the gravity model, that, you know, this is kind of underachieving in the below potential, and then using a kind of different approach but similar kind of philosophy, the paper in the book Beyond Austerity also finds kind of under, you know, Greece performing below potential. But if you want to be very cynical, of course, you say that, well, actually, you know, you could add a dummy variable in your models to, you know, Greekness, and that would explain why Greece underperforms. Okay, maybe less so in the before-after comparison, but that you do, Manuel. But in a way, you know, the fact of the matter is that Greece did underperform. Greece did have this kind of not so very successful adjustment in terms of exports, and it was more kind of permanent valuation collapse of imports. Greece does have a problem of kind of penetrating, as we say in the past, global markets, and they just export, you know, oranges across the border, perhaps less than 100 miles further out. So, you know, you can think, well, this is a manifestation of underachievement below potential, or you can just be a bit more cynical and accept the fact of life that Greece does not have the potential. And then the question becomes a bit different. It's not how can we, you know, sort of make the marginal parametric change that will change the situation around, but actually kind of go back to the drawing board and think, okay, what should this country look like, and, you know, how can you really change it quite more dramatically? So I don't know if you would like to respond to this point, if you find any substance at this point, and what do you think about it?
So I can respond, yeah. So this first. So the motivation for this first point, this counterfactual that we read about Greek exports increasing by 25%, was precisely to address this point that you raised, that I think was in many people's minds. Okay, that perhaps, you know, I think it is fair to say that a lot of the prosperity that Greece saw in the first decade of the euro was to some extent a bubble. Okay, it was not sustainable. I think that much is fair. However, Greek exports increasing did not happen because of the bubble. Foreign buyers did not buy Greek goods because somehow Greece was boring enough. Okay, those two are unconnected. So some Greek producers were able to penetrate foreign markets, and they were able to do so at an increasing rate in that first decade of the euro. Okay? Now, perhaps the increase in exports was more significant for Greece than for other countries, exactly because Greece essentially had some catching up to do. Okay, so maybe, you know, this, and maybe as we reach the point of stability, this growth would slow down anyway. That's fine. But it means that Greece is not quite so special on the negative side if you look at the performance of that decade. And I think this is important because obviously we are experiencing this great failure of adjustment, this great failure of the big bubble, and then of adjusting to the bursting of the bubble. And I think it's very, very important that we identify exactly the reasons why Greece failed to adjust. And to do that, we have to see where Greece was more successful, okay, and to separate that from the times of from the parts where it was less successful, okay. We just cannot say that everything was bad, and therefore there's nothing to look forward to.
Mm-hmm. I think just come quickly. You know, there's also a bit of a trick. I don't want to criticize the proposition that you make, but you're looking at kind of export growth rather than export as a sort of GDP. As I understand it.
But it increased. Export over GDP also increased. Yeah.
But much more marginally than 67%.
So
the economy increased by 67% and exports increased by 67%. I don't dispute the point that, well, somebody was buying from outside. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it's not just because your economy grows, your exports would necessarily grow. And as we say, if it was just a bubble, it wouldn't have impacted, you know, been reflecting on the exports. But then, you know, by the same token, then if you lose 25% of your GDP proportionately, you may as well lose 25% of your export base, separate private kind of thing. So what I mean is that if you look at it in more proportional terms, the whole differences are less dramatic, you know, on the large scale. I mean, the point remains that export adjustment just didn't happen in the crisis, so I don't dispute that. But I'm just saying that, you know, maybe there is something which relates more to, you know, and of course one has to look at the reasons and your suggestions, kind of looking at the particular, you know, the new exporters, how did they manage, what do we learn about the other ones that didn't actually start exporting. It's all valuable. But I'm just saying whether there is something, you know, by looking at kind of parametric changes, we may, you know, like a little bit of change in employment relations or a little bit of deregulation here or there, may actually create too much optimism, whereas the problems may run much more deeply. So that's, I'm so, you know, presenting the pessimistic scenario, but.
I think, you know, it's important to distinguish two different issues. One is how we move from one level of equilibrium to another, and second is what is happening during this process. Our pragmatic argument is that if this process is taking 10 years, you need really to study and see, you know, what has been happening. This is what we are saying. I mean, you can theorize, you know, how you move from one level to another, misallocation of capital, whatever, but it's also important to look at the transition trajectory that the adjustment program, in the adjustment process in this country has been going through. Because then you will reveal, you know, important implications for policy. This is what they're saying.
Maybe I can start with one thing. So we don't allude in our paper to other EBRD work on which we've been engaged in very actively, the department I work in particular, over the past year, and that's looking at what we call the qualities of a sustainable market economy and trying to measure where each country stands relative to others. And when it comes to the case of Greece, which we're now measuring because it's one of our countries, so by the qualities I mean things like competitiveness, you know, how competitive an economy is, how integrated it is, how resilient it is to shocks, how inclusive it is it offering opportunities for all parts of society, how green it is. And on all of those, Greece doesn't do too badly. It's not great relative to other EU countries that we're still investing in, but it is still better than broadly the EBRD average. But the one that really falls down is governance. So a well-functioning, sustainable economy has to be well-governed, and Greece scores extremely poorly on that. You know, quite a bit below the EBRD average. And when you think of some of the countries where investing in them, that's and I think that has to be, I mean, that permeates everything. I think that it has, by governance we have, you know, we think broadly of public institutions. It also covers corporate governance as well, but you know, it's things like quality of public administration. It touches on issues of, you know, corruption and bureaucratic inefficiency and so on, and Greece is really lagging behind in that. So I think that is part of the picture that we don't really. It's sort of the elephant in the room, if you like, in the background of all of this work, I think, discussion about exports.
Let me open up the discussion that we have. Okay. There was a question there. Can you please quickly introduce yourselves very quickly and ask questions?
Hello, thank you very much. My name is Irene Martin. I'm a political scientist. I'm currently visiting fellow at the Hellenic Observatory. And because I'm a political scientist, I'm very interested in that variable political instability. And I wanted to ask you what you think is behind it, because it's a bit of a black box, which could be related to the moment when the survey was taken, or it could be related to real changes from one government to the other in terms of legislation, or it could be related to the image that Greece has abroad, which may correspond to reality or not so much, because I have the impression that the legacy of the crisis has done a lot of harm, and there is this image of political instability is going to remain for a long time, no matter what happens in Greece and no matter the improvements that you have also been mentioning. Thank you.
It's a very good question and touches on an issue that we always have to have in our minds when we look at survey data. So what are people thinking about when they answer questions? And I'm afraid we have to some extent, we have to resort to just intuition and guesswork when it comes to that. I think when you give political instability as a potential obstacle, I suppose, and given when the survey was carried out, it was the memories of 2015 who were still very fresh in people's minds. So the difficulties in electing a president at the start, the general election, then the rather chaotic period, let's say the first 6 months of the Syriza government, culminating this referendum in July, and then the new program, and then further elections. So I think all of that, it is destabilizing for businesses. It did, I think, damage the economy. It led to a lot of loss of confidence, both internally and on the part of investors. So we felt that at the ERD, we were able to operate from, I think, March 2015 until, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was very difficult to do any business until much later in the year when things had settled down a bit. So almost a year was lost, I think. So I think that's what people have in mind. I mean, they may have in mind things like image of the country as well, but one would have to then go back up and do kind of focus group surveys to probe that, and we just don't do that. We don't have the resources for that. So,
okay. Yes.
At a higher level of abstraction, I'm afraid, I'm asking myself, what is the comparative advantage that we're trying to exploit? And from what happened tonight, I think the conclusion must be that we're further backward than we have in a comparative advantage, even more backward. And therefore, we can make up more ground than everybody else. We have better banks, we have more corruption, we have volatile electorates, whatever. And if we improve on all these, we gain ground from the rest. That's a fair point, I think. But we must understand also very clearly that it is a result of comparative advantage that we're, or disadvantage, if you like, that we're in the state we're in now. And that, by that I mean that goods exports or competitiveness in goods markets in the world has been affected by a great success in shipping, tourism, and a great source of funds for many years, remittances. These, via the exchange rate, created terms of trade, real terms of trade, crowded out exports of goods. And this is the legacy that we have, and which needs to be addressed, so to speak, basically. If we can get a new impetus, as it were, we need to understand the history behind the present state of affairs. I'm hoping that by just taking these little bits at a time, little bits on a very macro level, but important, hugely important. We can make a lot of ground, but it's going to be hard work. Let me give you, I'm sorry I'm taking a bit long, but an anecdote. When in London, invited by his counterpart. He brought with him a group of agricultural exporters to discuss the trade deal with Sainsbury's about an agricultural product, I forget which. The minister met his counterpart and the trade delegation met their Sainsbury's. A few minutes later they came out, the Greek agriculturists. They came out and said, meeting concluded. What happened? Well, they asked for 1 million kilos. We can't provide 1 million kilos. This is now a structural problem at a lower level, if you like. And, the level at which we're discussing here is the middle ground, and very important. But there are all these nuances that is behind the story.
Very interesting question. Professor Sparrows knows the Greek economy very well from different positions. Would somebody like to take this point about the kind of macro kind of terms of trade argument, but also potentially the capacity of the crown, fermentation of production, maybe at the micro level?
No, for the reasons Professor Sparrows is implying, Greece is not a catching up economy anymore. So, you know, in order to, you know, bring Greece to a sustainable growth path, quality of institutions is very important. But also, we need to be really targeted about by the, as you say, the micro level. To give you an example, 40 years later, we went to the market and micro producers in Greece and tried to see if they get the right support in order to export. And we are back to what you are suggesting. It is not there. And the opportunity cost of 40 years of EU funds that never targeted this micro level problem is quite high.
It's okay. Another question.
Thanks. I'd just like to ask about the econometric model. I didn't quite understand what was going on. Maybe you could tell us the message a little bit more. But as I saw it, or understood it, you're trying to explain productivity by some variables related to export size or something like that, size of companies in relation to exports. But surely if you want to understand the problems, the obstacles to exports, you would want the exports to be the dependent variable and the productivity to be the independent variable. So you would explain, you know, how productivity is varying in relation to, sorry, how export performance is varying in relation to various set of variables. And secondly, I noticed the ask words were incredibly low. I mean, I know you're not supposed to take too much notice of that in cross-section studies, but it does mean that there's a huge amount of the variation that is unexplained.
Yeah. The points are very well taken, Will. Just on the last one, the R squares, they do improve a bit when you bring down the exporters into the superstars, the exporters and small exporters. But your broad point is absolutely right. It's or your implied point that it's a very simple or simplistic model. It's actually two different models. So one is explaining employment by productivity, and the other is explaining productivity by employment. And in both cases, we have added other variables in. So it should be taken with a large grain of salt. But the employment equations are 1 and 3, and the productivity. I rushed through this the first time. So this is log, L here stands for log, so this is log of full-time employment, this is log of labor productivity, so the productivity equations are 2 and 4, and the differences between 1 and 3 and between 2 and 4 have to do with whether you just look at all exporters together, or whether you break it down into these three different categories. There are some sectoral dummies as well, which are not included in the table, but they're in the background. So that's what's going on. It's an area where I think we could, you know, push this out a bit further and maybe make this a little bit more sophisticated. Keeping in mind, though, the limitations of the data. It's not a huge data set, of 300 or so observations, actually less when you clean them and you're probably, you know, missing variables and so on. So that's what it is. But just again to emphasize the main point that there is a correlation between being an exporter and product size and productivity when you break it into this breakout strip at the top level ones, but not when you look just at the small exporters.
Okay, there's one more question.
Carrying on from what Professor Strauss was talking about, the difference between looking at the micro level, the firm, and so on before aggregating total exports. You have mentioned it in your own study. You mentioned the star performance. Star performance presumably are very large firms, as I understand it. And then you have the rest. And this is precisely the problem. Who are the rest? And they are the vast majority of Greek firms. So really what we need there is essentially emerging activity of all those smaller firms into creating much bigger corporations which will have the necessary expertise or can, because of size, can engage the necessary people who will do the marketing abroad for export markets and the like. There are very many small such firms in the periphery, in the regions, producing quite good products and all the rest of it, but only recently have managed, in the last 5 or 6 years, have managed to break into the Athens market. Never mind, go abroad. So before you can, and of course, what you have is the statistical service telling us the small industry consists of firms employing from 1 to 10 individuals, and large industry, anyone from 10 and above. Now, when you consider what happens in other European countries, large industry really means anyone from 300, 400 and above. And therein, I think, lies the problem. I mean, your own study has shown that the star performers are really the large firms. How many large firms do we have in this? And therefore, if there is to be an improvement in that particular area, it must start from there. You may even have large commercial firms who will collect all these agricultural products that Professor Strauss would say they've asked us for 1 million kilos and we haven't got it, or tons and we haven't got it. Well, go and find it, because the stuff is there. Thank you for it. Yeah. And therefore, if we were to consider the SMS becoming larger and larger, perhaps we may have an improvement.
How do you make the small medium? Any responses?
I mean, just to say that this is a point that pattern we've seen in some other countries as well. In fact, our latest transition report, I'm advertising all the EBRD products here, but the EBRD transition report, which we publish every November, the latest one it's on the theme of growth, and one of the chapters looks at exactly this point, that the countries that tend to lag behind are those with an extremely high percentage of small firms. And you know, I mean, at the EBRD, we like to do everything we can to help small, micro, and small businesses. We have a number of products, you know, working usually with local banks and
financial intermediaries to help them. And we, you know, we say small, it's beautiful, but actually, when it comes to being really a rich dynamic company, you need the large firms to generate the growth rather than the small ones. How you get from one to the other, that's I don't have an answer to that. And maybe my colleagues here have some insights on that.
I would add 3 points. One is, of course, the SME is the bulk of what is being produced in Greece. So supply side policies need to be to address problems like what you are suggesting, and government policies need to become more targeted and more effective. Second, we will see a lot of restructuring where the NPL business will start moving, because there we have a lot of zombie capacity being hiding. And third, I would say it's important to distinguish what is big in Greek terms. Yeah, it is not compared to what is big in the EU. So we really need to see how a second layer of business groups in Greece will become more export oriented. So I would say these are the 3 drivers that might lead to some improvement in the near future.
Okay, I have another question that I want to ask, and have a bit of time, so if there's no other question, I'll ask later. Wait for me.
Hi, I'm George Lewis, I'm a marketing consultant as well, so I have worked in exports for quite a number of years. I'm advising the firms, both in the UK and in Greece, so more or less, I'm quite passionate about that subject matter. Nevertheless, I just want to talk about the variables which happen to be microvariables. And it's striking to me that the microvariables have not been identified. And actually, the priority in the export business, it has to do much more with internal capabilities rather than with external factors. Would you like to address that?
Actually, we had this conference with the Bank of Greece in December, and we invited corporates from exactly your point. We invited corporates from different sectors, from chemicals to honey production, and IT, and five different sectors. Completely different context, but exactly the similarity you're suggesting. Competent management with clear targets, building assets through the years, and reaching out to other markets.
So, yes.
No stakes, that's my question. No stakes, very
good. Thank you for a very informative presentation. And I was wondering, when you measured from 2000 to 2008, so if you are looking into the after the euro, where about before that? That's 1 point. Because I've seen the current account from the 80s to today, and there was a huge impact with the euro. And it's typical that everybody compares Greece to Germany, and they do go to the different spectrum. And from 2000 to 2001, they go from 40 billion deficit to 20 billion surplus, basically. And the other thing is productivity, that the gentleman there mentioned, I can't remember the name. And there is a recent OECD report about the working hours. And Greece is on the one spectrum with over 2,000 hours annually. And on the other spectrum within the European Union is Germany with 1,300. And even though they work 75% or 80% less, they are on top productivity. So I was wondering if you'd like to comment on
this. So the current, so the current account.
Euro and productivity.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So Greece joined the euro in 2001 and was essentially a fixed exchange rate for the preceding since 1999 or so. So after the euro was created, what you see is that a huge increase in the deficits of the benefit countries like Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, and a huge increase in the surplus of the core countries like Germany, but also Austria, Finland, Netherlands, and so on. So actually, that was my plenary talk here a couple of years ago at the plenary I went through. So that includes the euro. The part about exports is that, so basically, a lot of money went into the peripheral countries. One of the things that this money is trying to do is that it's going to stimulate internal consumption, it's going to increase prices and wages internally. It should make, in principle, those countries less competitive. The fact that exports increased much more for those countries, especially in particular Greece, suggests to me that this money was also, at least part of it, invested. Okay, because had there been no investment, just simply the increase in prices and wages would have crowded out Greek exports and made them completely uncompetitive in the rest of the world, which is the opposite from what happened. So on this one, productivity, one of the things about the data is that we're not comparing really likes to likes. So Greece has a very low proportion of self-employed, part-time workers. So up until recently it was something like 10%, now it's a little bit higher. So when you compare the average hours of work in Greece to other countries, you're comparing also to some extent different proportions of full-time versus part-time workers. Now beyond that, of course, full-time workers in Greece do work longer hours than Germans do, for example. And there, of course, the difference in productivity is because of higher, better organization, more capital in Germany and so on. I'm not sure that answers your question.
The OECD house data is also a bit of a magical figure, and it's difficult to see where they come from. There's many people in Greece who work 60 hours, and they look like the self-employed who, you know, the shopkeepers and stuff, which is then, you know, you can think in terms of productivity, you wouldn't necessarily think that they, you know, they're occupied, but they're not producing constantly, if you know what I mean. So they're there, yes, they work, but they don't actually produce at all.
Yeah.
Okay, we can take another minute or two for the last question, and then we have to bring it to a close.
Hi, it's Chris Vassopoulos, former head of IFA finance at a great financial institution, currently paid practitioner in Europe. So my question was around the weight of fuel oil imports and also exports of oil and byproducts, petroleum byproducts, in your search, in your data. And how do you weigh it out? How do you make your assumptions on that commodity, which is crucially important for both sides, inputs and exports?
You were talking about that chart I showed earlier.
I was talking about the split in the goods that you have made between goods and services. That's what prompted the question.
Yeah, no, this is a very good point. Let me just show you again the. So I will have not a very good answer, I'm afraid.
Okay. It's always troublesome for me in order to calculate the environment there.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just take a minute to respond here. Okay, so goods here, this includes mineral products, okay? Which increased, so between 2008 and 2016, increased by about 45%. If you look at the shorter period, between 2008 and 2012, we actually almost doubled, I think, or 80%, the increase dramatically. So my understanding is that is something that's not necessarily a big success for the following reason. So you have a lot of refining capacity in Greece, which before was serving the internal market. And when the internal market kind of collapsed, it started being exported. Now, so far, this is nothing bad. The problem here is that this is, as I understand it, it's a relatively low margin job. So basically, now you're importing expensive oil, you're adding a little bit of value to it, and then you're re-exporting it. So looking only at the exports is a little bit misleading. In particular, what ideally one would like to do is to look at the value added embedded in exports. So value added embedded in this kind of refined products is relatively small because it's a low margin business. Value added embedded in perhaps in manufacturing or perhaps in some other sectors might be higher. I don't have this data, so unfortunately I couldn't do that. Now, this was very, very important in the early years, exactly because the price of oil had increased a lot after, since then it has fallen back, so if you look at the 2016-2015 data, it doesn't skew the data as much as it would have in the earlier data. But this is a point well taken, and I don't have a good answer.
Okay, I'm afraid we have to stop here. I will ask my question privately. Okay, thanks everybody for coming, and please join me in thanking the speakers and our discussion for the presentation.